After hearing and seeing McKinney's victory shout, Conrad's nerves didn't bother him anymore. His goal was in plain sight. All he had to do was reach it. He played with a cool-headed resolution, taking chances when his instincts told him it might pay off. Most of the time, he was right. The pile of chips in front of him began to grow, as the chips in front of Gray dwindled. With McKinney emerging victorious at the other table, theirs was the only game left. Men gathered around the table to watch. They were careful not to get too close and distract the players, but Conrad and Gray were definitely the center of attention. McKinney came over and watched several hands with a sneer on his face. Conrad ignored him. He raised 2,000. Gray called. Conrad took the pot with two pair. He won the next two hands as well. On the next hand, he got two eights and two jacks on the deal. He bet 10,000. Without hesitation, Gray saw the bet and raised it 5 grand. Conrad discarded the three that had come with the eights and the jacks and dealt himself a third jack. He bumped the bet up 10,000 more. Back and forth the bet went, each man grim-faced with determination as the pot grew to staggering proportions. If he lost that hand, Conrad realized, he wouldn't be out of the game, but his chances would be severely crippled. The same was true of his opponent. Gray knew that too.
There's no point in dragging this out.
He waved a hand toward the chips he had left.
Everything. I'll bet it all.
It was a desperate move. Conrad counted quickly. He was $1,000 short of being able to cover the bet. He had to fold in order to have anything left for the next hand. A chip sailed onto the table and landed on the pot.
It's on me, Browning. Call him.
Conrad turned his head to look at the rancher.
Why would you want to help me out, Rance?
Because you're the one I want to face. Not this pasty-faced tinhorn.
Anger kindled in Gray's eyes. He leaned forward about to say something, but Bat Masterson stepped up to the table.
Gentlemen, let's not have any trouble here.
Masterson reached down and picked up the chip McKinney had thrown into the pot.
Sorry, Rance. Stakes are limited to what each man has on the table.
McKinney looked like he was going to argue, but Gray spoke up first.
With your permission, Bat, I'll withdraw $1,000 from my bet. Browning can call now.
Masterson looked at Conrad.
I call.
Conrad pushed his chips forward. Gray turned his cards over.
Full house. Tens over threes.
Conrad's pulse thundered in his ears. He laid his cards face up on the table.
I have a full house, too. Jacks over eights.
Gray stared at the cards for a second, then closed his eyes.
The pot is yours.
Gray picked up his lone remaining chip and tossed it across the table onto the pile in front of Conrad.
I don't see any point in playing another hand. Game is yours as well, Mr. Browning.
Conrad glanced at Masterson, who nodded in agreement. The outcome of the next hand was a foregone conclusion. Playing it out would have been a waste of time. Masterson drew out his watch and checked the time.
It's just after noon. The final round will begin at 6 o'clock this evening, if that's agreeable to the players.
Fine by me.
All right.
6 o'clock, then. And may the best man win.
McKinney's sneer made it clear he had no doubt who that was going to be. Despite the weariness that gripped him, Conrad told Masterson to have one of the hostesses wake him in 3 hours.
There's a barber just down the street. I want to get cleaned up, and if there's time, I'll go to the hospital and see Arturo.
Just be careful when you leave here. Rose Sullivan is still out there somewhere. She might make another try for you.
I doubt that. Now that she knows we're on to her, she's probably left town.
He wasn't completely convinced of that, even as he said it. He didn't really know what Rose was capable of. The 3 hours of sleep blunted his exhaustion, and after a hot bath and a shave, Conrad felt considerably better as he dressed in fresh clothes he'd had sent over. His spirits perked up even more when he reached the hospital and saw how much better Arturo looked. He was sitting up in bed, with his left arm in a black silk sling. A tray of food was in front of him, and he was pushing the remains of a meal around listlessly with a fork. He smiled, his mood visibly brightening, as Conrad came in.
It's good to see you, sir. Does this mean the tournament is over?
No, but the final round will be starting before much longer. Me against Rance McKinney.
Well, that's what you wanted, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm going to see if I can't get McKinney to talk about Pamela.
Well, you don't expect him to admit much about her in front of everyone who'll be watching, do you?
All I want to know is whether or not she had the twins with her when she was here in Denver before. And if she did, whether he knows what she did with them. That's enough about my problems. How are you feeling?
Arturo looked down at his tray with disdain.
Well, I'd be much better if they had some decent food here. I'm not sure, but I think I could have gotten a better meal at Luigi's.
I can see if I could get something sent over from there.
No, that's not necessary. I don't expect that I'll be staying here much longer. I can put up with the hospital food until then. Otherwise, I'm doing quite well, as long as I remember not to move this arm very much.
I'm glad to hear that.
Is there still a gunman out in the hallway?
You mean the guard the bat sent over? Yeah, somebody's still out there keeping an eye on you.
Do you really think that's necessary?
As long as Rose Sullivan, or whatever her name is loose, I don't think it'll hurt anything.
Oh, very well. I don't see that I represent much of a threat to Miss Sullivan, but I suppose you know more about this sort of thing than I do. After all, a lot more people have tried to kill you.
That's the truth.
Conrad visited with Arturo for a while longer, then looked at his watch and saw it was time he needed to be getting back to the palace.
If you find out anything, let me know right away. Any time of the day or night.
I doubt if the nurses would let me in here in the middle of the night.
Oh, I doubt that. I never saw a place yet you couldn't charm your way into.
I'll see you tomorrow.
He was solemn again by the time he reached the palace. Before the night was over, he might know more about the fate of his children, or he might discover that the whole thing had been an exercise in futility. With the way the search had gone so far, it was hard to know what to expect. Quite a few of the men who had taken part in the tournament were in the private room, drinking and smoking. Their $10,000 buy-in had bought them that privilege. They would be allowed to witness the conclusion of one of the biggest poker games ever held west of the Mississippi. All of the tables had been cleared out except the one where Conrad and McKinney would play. Their chips were stacked up neatly on each side. McKinney was already at the table, slumped and brooding in his chair. When Conrad came up and rested his hand on the back of the opposite chair, McKinney's eyes rose to lock with his for a second. A hatred much deeper than a man would normally feel for an opponent in a game burned in McKinney's gaze. Once again, Conrad wondered what had caused the rancher to feel that way about him. It had to have something to do with Pamela.
Do either of you need a drink or something to eat before we begin?
I could use a cup of coffee.
Let's just get this over with.
Masterson motioned for one of the hostesses to bring the coffee, then reached inside his coat and brought out a sealed pack of fresh cards. He slit the seal with a thumbnail, removed it, shuffled the cards deftly, and placed them in the center of the table.
Cut for deal, gentlemen.
Conrad nodded to McKinney.
Go ahead.
McKinney reached out and took some of the cards off the top of the deck. He cut the Queen of Hearts.
Conrad?
Lazily, apparently completely at ease, Conrad leaned forward and cut the deck as well. He turned up the Ace of Spades.
The deal is yours. Good luck, gentlemen. Let the game begin.
There hadn't been a lot of talk during the previous games. Some men liked to have some conversation along with their cards, but most serious players had little to say except things that had to do with the game. The men taking part in the high-stakes tournament were all serious players, no doubt about that. McKinney was almost completely silent and uncommunicative. He said how many cards he wanted and announced whether he was calling or raising, and that was it. He sullenly ignored Conrad's attempts at small talk. It wasn't going to be easy to get McKinney to spill whatever he knew about Pamela. Conrad was going to have to figure out a way to make it part of the game. He won the first few hands. The trend made McKinney scowl darkly. Then the rancher took a good-sized pot, and for a second, a triumphant grin flashed across his face.
Maybe your luck is changing.
Luck's got nothing to do with it. It was only a matter of time.
Conrad took the deal right back by winning the next hand. McKinney's features darkened with rage. His brief taste of winning made losing even more difficult for him to swallow, Conrad thought. Even though he had decent cards, Conrad folded the next two hands. The pots weren't huge, and his stake was big enough he could afford to lose them. McKinney felt better again. As the next hand got underway, Conrad looked at his cards.
I'm curious about the time you spent with Pamela while she was here in Denver. Why don't we sweeten the pot a little? You tell me more about her visit, and I'll take that in lieu of a raise.
You're loco. That's none of your business.
Conrad saw some of the spectators exchanging puzzled glances. His suggestion definitely was odd. He pressed ahead with it anyway.
Can't blame me for being interested. She and I were engaged at one time, you know.
Not when I knew her.
No, but that doesn't mean I didn't care about her anymore.
Care?
McKinney shook his head.
5,000.
He pushed chips into the middle of the table.
I'll see that and raise 5.
Conrad added a couple of stacks of his own chips to the pot. He didn't say anything else about Pamela as that hand continued. After a couple of more raises, Conrad called and won the pot with four nines. McKinney threw in his cards disgustedly.
Could have saved yourself some money if you'd taken me up on my offer.
Go to hell.
Too late. I've already been there.
Damn it! Are we here to play cards or to gossip?
In answer to that, Conrad began dealing the next hand. He won several hands and was well ahead in the game before he brought up the subject again.
Did you visit Pamela at her hotel while she was here?
You've sullied the woman's good name enough.
I didn't say anything improper happened. I just wondered if you met her children.
He watched McKinney's dark, hooded eyes. There was no flicker of response in them, and Conrad's heart sank. Was it possible his instincts were wrong? Could McKinney have been telling him the truth all along?
Well, I don't know anything about no kids. Give me two cards, blast it.
Conrad dealt the two cards.
What about the nurse traveling with her?
McKinney ignored the question as if he hadn't heard it. The pot rose steadily as the two men traded bets. The spectators were quiet and attentive. Enough chips were in the center of the table that the hand was serious business.
20,000 more.
McKinney pushed out the chips.
That's 50 to me.
Conrad didn't look at his cards. He knew what sort of hand he held.
I'll see the bet and raise 10.
See it in 20 more.
Make it an even 100,000.
No one said anything. The room was so quiet, it was like Bat Masterson and the other spectators weren't even breathing. If McKinney saw the bet, more than $500,000 in chips would be piled in the center of the table. Conrad saw a gray pallor under McKinney's permanent tan. The rancher looked at his cards, looked at the big pile of chips, looked across the table at Conrad.
I'll call.
He pushed out the chips to make it official. Conrad laid down four queens. McKinney's fingers involuntarily clenched on the cards in his hand. Breathing hard, he forced his fingers open and let the cards drop on the table. All of them were hearts. The 2, 3, 7, 9, and Jack. The flush was a good hand, but not good enough to beat Conrad's four ladies. Just like that, McKinney's stake was down to about 200,000. Conrad had 750,000 in front of him, once he'd pulled in the pot.
You couldn't be that lucky.
Careful, Rance. I was watching every move the two of you made. So were all these other fellas. There was nothing shady about that hand.
Then you won't be that lucky again. Deal 'em.
I think we'll have a new deck first. You sort of bent some of those cards, Rance.
McKinney didn't apologize for ruining the deck. He sat impatiently while Masterson got out a new one and broke the seal. With the new cards in play, Conrad dealt.
If you want to stay in the game, maybe you'd better consider my offer, McKinney. Tell me the truth about Pamela Tarleton.
I've told you all I know.
I don't believe you.
McKinney started up from his chair.
You calling me a liar?
Rance, sit down.
Masterson looked over at Conrad.
You're supposed to be playing a game here, Conrad.
Offending Bat Masterson was the least of Conrad's worries. He sensed McKinney was about to crack. He just needed to apply a little more pressure.
What's the bet?
McKinney settled back down in his chair.
Let me look at my damn cards.
McKinney snatched up the hand Conrad had dealt him.
I'll open for 20.
I'm in. Cards?
3.
Conrad dealt the cards and drew one for himself. McKinney didn't miss that, he noted. Conrad had tried for a full house but failed, leaving him with 3 nines. McKinney bet 10,000 and Conrad folded. Could have stayed in easily and possibly won, but he wanted to offer McKinney a shred of hope and then snatch it away. With the deal again, McKinney's confidence appeared to rise slightly. Conrad opened for 20,000. McKinney matched it. After the draw, Conrad raised 5. McKinney saw that and raised 10 more. Conrad kept the pressure on with small raises that McKinney obviously felt like he had to match. His raises were reckless. The bet went back and forth, and almost before anyone knew what was happening, the pot was big enough that McKinney was forced to push in the rest of his chips. With his face haggard and drawn, he waited to see if Conrad was going to match the bet and raise again.
Everything.
You son of a bitch!
McKinney would have come out of his chair if Masterson's hand hadn't dropped firmly on his shoulder and held him down.
You know I don't have it. You're not even giving me a damn chance.
Yes, I am. The truth about Pamela Tarleton will cover the bet.
I've told you the truth.
I want to know about the children.
The two of them locked eyes across the table. The atmosphere in the room was one of breathless anticipation.
Fine. I'll tell you what I know. but not until after the hand.
Not good enough. You could be lying about knowing anything.
Two children, right? A boy and a girl?
Conrad's heart slugged in his chest. His hunch had been right all along. McKinney did know something about the children.
That's all you're getting until I see your cards.
Fine.
McKinney laid down his cards.
Pair of kings.
All I have is a pair, too.
He laid down the ace of clubs, followed by the ace of spades. The black aces were enough. The game was over. Rance McKinney seemed to shrink in his chair like a balloon with the air leaking out of it. For a split second, he'd felt a flicker of hope when Conrad said he only had a pair as well. There was only one hand that would beat McKinney's two kings. Conrad's two aces had done it, and McKinney was wiped out. Cheers went up for many of the men in the room, indicating that McKinney wasn't well-liked among the group. They were happier to see a relative stranger win. Several of them pounded Conrad on the back in congratulations. Conrad watched McKinney across the table, shaking his head like he couldn't believe what had just happened. The hate-filled gaze he gave Conrad was even darker than before. Conrad pushed his chips to the side.
You'll take care of this, won't you, Bat?
Of course. Do you prefer a bank draft or cash?
A bank draft will be fine. Send it over to Ellery's office tomorrow, will you?
Sure, if that's the way you want it.
Drinks for everyone, and take it out of my winnings.
You heard the man.
The spectators surged out of the private room to head for the bar, leaving Conrad and McKinney alone, except for Masterson and a few stragglers.
I believe you owe me something.
You bastard. If I had a gun,
you'd be dead. Because if you were armed, Conrad would be too. Even if he wasn't, I am. There'll be no gunplay in here. The palace may not be my place anymore, but the owner is a friend of mine, and I won't have it shot up.
No gunplay. But you're going to have to pay off your bet, McKinney. Otherwise, you'll be known from one end of the frontier to the other as a Welsher.
Fine. I don't know what business it is of yours, but Pamela Tarleton had those two kids with her, along with a nurse. A boy and a girl, like I said. They weren't much more than babies.
Do you remember their names?
Yeah. The little boy was Frank. The little girl was called Vivian.
Conrad felt like he'd been punched in the gut. Would Pamela really be that cruel? Would she really have named the children after Conrad's parents? But she must have, because McKinney had no reason to lie about it. He might know that Conrad's mother was Vivian Browning, but he wouldn't have any idea that Conrad's father was Frank Morgan. That information wasn't strictly a secret, but it wasn't known to very many people, and no one who knew would have told McKinney about it.
What else can you tell me?
That's it. I saw the kids and the nurse one time, and Pamela didn't explain anything about them. I didn't figure it was any of my business.
They went with her when she left for San Francisco?
As far as I know.
Were they happy? Well cared for?
Happy? How the hell would I know if they were happy? They were little kids. But that nurse seemed to be taking care of them just fine.
Anything else?
I can't think of a damn thing. You satisfy, you some bitch?
Take it easy.
Why wouldn't you tell me any of this before?
Why the hell would I want to? I don't owe you anything. At least I didn't until now. Can't believe you beat me with a pair of aces.
You were trying to beat me with a pair of kings.
McKinney shoved his chair back.
We done here?
We're done.
Look at it this way, Rance. All you really lost was the 10 grand you used to buy into the game. Winnings come and go.
Yeah, that makes me feel a hell of a lot better.
McKinney stalked out of the room. Everyone else had drifted away. Conrad and Masterson were alone in the room.
Do you believe him?
I think so.
Was it worth it? You spent days playing poker and risked a small fortune, and what did you really learn?
That I haven't reached the end of the trail yet. I didn't overlook the place where Pamela hid the children. She left here with them and headed on to San Francisco.
There's still lots of rough country between here and there.
I know, and I plan to check at every place along the railroad just to make sure I don't overlook anything. But my gut is telling me that I won't find the twins until I reach the coast.
San Francisco is a big town. Lots of places to hide a couple of young'uns.
That's true, but I have nothing but time to look for them.
Masterson extended a hand.
Good luck.
Conrad shook with him.
What now?
As soon as Arturo is in good enough shape to travel, we'll head west again.
You could leave him here.
I know I could, but he's come this far with me and risked his life to help me. I reckon he deserves to be in on the finish.
That'll give you a while to rest up after this tournament, I suppose.
I could use it. Playing for such high stakes will wear a man out. I think I'll go back to the hotel, have a good meal, and then sleep for another 12 hours or so.
I'll walk over to the Lansing house with you.
Worried about me, Bat?
I'm sure the word's already getting around town that you won almost $1 million tonight.
Which you're going to have delivered in the form of a bank draft to my lawyer tomorrow.
Wrong. I'm not going to have it delivered. I'm going to hand it over to Ellery Hudson myself. I don't trust that much money to anybody but me.
That's fine. I'm glad to hear it.
Not everybody who hears about your big win will know that you don't have the cash, so we're not going to take any chances.
Fine. I won't argue with you. Anyway, I could use a company. It'll help keep me awake.
The two men got their hats and left the palace. Conrad knew he should be glad he had finally gotten more information from McKinney, but he felt strangely empty inside. Masterson was right. He hadn't really learned all that much, especially considering the strain of the past few days. And he had no way of knowing that McKinney had told him the truth, even though the rancher hadn't seemed to be lying. Conrad and Masterson walked toward the Lansing house.
You said that McKinney has a pretty good-sized spread?
That's right. The Double Star is northwest of Boulder.
Pretty rugged country?
Some of it. McKinney's range runs from the plains, through the foothills, and on up into the mountains. He's got a mighty tough crew and runs the place like it's his own little kingdom.
In other words, you could hide a couple small children there without much trouble.
Masterson looked over sharply at him.
What the hell? You think Pamela stashed the kids with him?
I can't rule it out. I know there was a connection between the two of them. Maybe his reluctance to talk was just part of Pamela's game. Maybe he was trying to fool me all along.
No offense, Conrad, but you're thinking too blasted much. You talk about Pamela like she was some sort of, I don't know, evil genius.
You're not too far off the mark there, Bat.
When you think like that, you wind up just going around and around in circles. You can't ever trust your instincts because Pamela might have anticipated that and made allowances for it.
You're right. But she's been two or three steps in front of me the whole way, Bat. How can I not consider every possibility?
Well, consider this possibility.
They reached the Lansing house and paused in front of the hotel's entrance.
If you start poking around McKinney's ranch, you're liable to get yourself shot full of holes.
That's a chance I may have to take.
Masterson looked at him for a long moment, then nodded.
If you decide to take a ride up there, let me know.
You want to come with me?
Damn right I do. I don't like McKinney much either. If he's got those kids stashed away, then he deserves whatever he's got coming to him.
Thanks, Ben. I'll let you know.
Masterson tipped a finger to the brim of his hat as Conrad went into the hotel. He walked past a gray-haired, stoop-shouldered maid and had his key in the door of his room before he realized a maid probably wouldn't be working that late at night. He turned swiftly, but he was too late. Rose Sullivan stared out at him from under the gray wig, and the little pistol in her hand was pointed right between his eyes.
Don't make me kill you, Conrad.
Instinct made him clamp down on his nerves. He didn't want to do anything that would startle her into pulling the trigger. She was just out of easy reach, but not far enough away that he could dive out of the line of fire. A little more pressure of her finger on the trigger would put a bullet in his brain. In the back of his mind, he was cursing himself for getting caught. The strain of the poker tournament and the things Rance McKinney had told him had filled up his head to the point that, which, while he hadn't forgotten about Rose, he hadn't taken the threat she posed seriously enough.
I thought you wanted to kill me, Rose. You've been trying hard enough to do just that ever since I've been in Denver.
Things have changed.
What do you want?
Go ahead and unlock the door, then go into your room. Don't make any fuss about it. If you raise a commotion and anybody sticks his head out to investigate, I will kill him. That person's blood will be on your hands.
Take it easy.
He started to turn toward the door.
Carefully.
Taking it slow, Conrad finished unlocking the door and turned the knob. He swung the door open. The room inside was dark.
Go on.
As Conrad stepped into the darkened room, he sensed her rushing up behind him. He knew she probably wanted to knock him out, so he twisted aside and flung an arm out behind him and snagged the sleeve of the nondescript dress she wore in her disguise as a maid. Closing his hand on the material, he dragged her with him. They went sprawling onto the floor. Conrad kicked the door closed, figuring she wouldn't start blazing away blindly, The shadows were his friends. He rolled over onto his belly, then laid absolutely still. Silence greeted his ears. Rose knew any noise she made would tell him where she was, and yet they couldn't lie there forever, trying to wait each other out. Sooner or later, somebody would have to move. A little light from the gas street lamps outside penetrated through the tiny gap in the curtains over the window, and more light seeped under the door from the corridor. Conrad's eyes began to adjust. He could make out the vague shapes of the sitting room's furniture. His guns were all in the next room, but he couldn't reach them without betraying his presence. Still, he needed to be closer so he wouldn't have as far to go to get them when the showdown came. He slid a couple of inches in that direction, the carpet on the floor making his movements silent. A carriage team suddenly clattered by in the street outside. Rose might use that noise to cover up any sounds she made, Conrad thought. He lifted his head to look for her and saw a flicker of motion to his right. That gray dress she was wearing. It loomed in the air as she leaped at him. Surging to his feet, Conrad lifted his hands to grapple with her. He reached for her arm and tried to grab the wrist of her gun hand so he could keep the pistol pointed away from him. He caught hold of empty fabric. He heard the springs on the divan sag under a sudden weight. Then something crashed into his back and drove him forward on his knees. In the split seconds, as he was falling, he knew Rose had slipped out of the dress and thrown it into the air to lure him into moving, then leaped onto the divan and from there onto his back. As he landed on the floor with her solid weight on his back, the impact drove the air from his lungs. The next instant, one of her arms looped around his neck and closed on it with incredible strength, keeping him from drawing a breath.
You think a woman can't fight? You think we're all weaklings?
He didn't recall ever saying that, and he certainly wouldn't say it about Rose Sullivan, or whatever her name was. She obviously took her job as a hired killer seriously and was in superb shape. The lack of air was making his head spin as unconsciousness threatened to overwhelm him. But he was bigger, heavier, and stronger than her, he told himself. He had to be able to break loose from her grip. He got a hand under him, then a knee, and heaved himself off the floor, taking her with him. Pitching to the side, he sent them crashing into the writing table against the wall of the sitting room. Rose's arm came loose. Conrad dragged air into his body as he twisted around and reached for her. A small but hard fist slugged into his face as she struck out blindly. The wig had come off, and he could tell she had tied her blonde hair up in a tight knot on top of her head. Before she could move away, Conrad hit her. She went limp, and even after everything that had happened, Conrad felt bad about hitting a woman. As she sprawled onto her back and her arms fell out on her sides, he stood up over her. Her foot came up with blinding speed and slammed into his groin. Pain exploded through him, bringing with it the knowledge that Rose had been pretending to be stunned. She had fooled him, and he cursed himself bitterly as the agony forced him to double over and fall to the floor. He heard the door of the suite open.
What the hell happened in here? You were supposed to get the drop on him.
It took a moment for Conrad to realize through his pain that the voice belonged to Rance McKinney.
Don't worry about that. Just take care of him.
Oh, I'll take care of him, all right.
Conrad wished he had a gun. Although he might not have been able to see straight to fire it, he would have tried anyway. But he didn't get the chance. Sometimes, just being alive came as a great surprise, which was how Conrad felt as awareness seeped back into his brain, along with a great deal of pounding agony. He had been knocked out before, so he knew what it was like to feel as if a band of demons was inside his skull, slugging away at it with ball-peen hammers. That was actually his pulse, and pain shot through his head with every beat of it. But that meant his heart was beating. When he'd passed out, it had been with the grim acceptance of death. Rose and McKinney would probably slit his throat while he was unconscious. Instead, he was alive, and he gradually became aware that he was moving. The rough surface on which he lay swayed back and forth underneath him. A musty stink filled his nostrils, and something scratchy rubbed against his face. After a few moments, he realized he was wrapped up in a blanket and probably lying in the back of a wagon. The roughness of the ride told him the vehicle wasn't rolling over Denver's paved streets. So he was out on the trail somewhere, he thought. The fact that McKinney had been in his hotel room along with Rose Sullivan gave him a pretty good idea where he and his captors were headed. They were on their way to McKinney's Double Star Ranch. Despite the pain in his head, Conrad forced himself to concentrate on the predicament in which he found himself. He remembered how Rose had slipped into the hotel in disguise and gotten the drop on him. The exchange she'd had with McKinney proved the two of them were working together. Conrad didn't know if that had been the case from the start, or if Rose had gone to McKinney for help after her true identity as a hired killer had been discovered. It didn't really matter, he told himself. What was important was that two very deadly enemies of his had teamed up, and he was now their prisoner. So far, he hadn't budged as awareness came back to him. He remained as motionless as possible. The wagon's bumps and jolts made him move a little, but he kept his muscles limp so that would look natural. The longer he could keep them from realizing he had regained consciousness, the better. When he got a chance to make a break for freedom, he wanted to take them by surprise. He wondered how long he had been out cold. It seemed like a long time, hours maybe, but he knew that feeling could be deceptive. Along with the hoofbeats of the team pulling the wagon, he could hear other horses. Outriders, more than likely. Maybe McKinney himself, since he struck Conrad as more the type to ride a horse than sit on a wagon. Rose would be on the wagon. He considered the possibility of throwing off the enshrouding blanket, grabbing her, and using her as a hostage. It wouldn't work, he decided. For one thing, he was too likely to get tangled up in the blanket and slowed down by it. For another, just because McKinney and Rose were working together didn't mean that he gave a damn what happened to her. If Conrad threatened to kill her, McKinney might just laugh and tell him to go ahead. Anyway, he wasn't the sort of man who used a woman as a shield, even a dangerous woman like Rose Sullivan. He would have to find another way out of the mess, and it would have to be soon.
There it is, Double Star Ranch. The last place that bastard Browning ever seen.
It was too late to make a move before they reached the ranch. The wagon came to a stop.
Let me give you a hand.
Obviously, he was helping her down from the wagon seat.
Get him out of there.
The wagon's tailgate dropped open. Strong hands reached into the wagon bed and took hold of the blanket-wrapped figure. Conrad felt himself being dragged toward the back of the wagon. They lifted him clear of the vehicle.
Dump him out.
The men let the musty blanket unroll. Conrad tumbled free. But instead of crashing limply to the ground as an unconscious man would have, he caught himself lively on his hands and feet. Men crowded around him and grabbed his arms. A fist crashed into his jaw and rocked his head back. In the chaos that surrounded him, Conrad couldn't tell exactly what was going on, but he heard McKinney.
Hold him!
A fist slammed into his belly. Conrad felt sick, but there was nothing in his belly to come up. McKinney hit him again and again, pounding him like a side of raw meat, while the cowboys held him up.
Reckon that knocked all the fight out of him. Let him go.
The men released Conrad. He tried to stay on his feet, but his legs wouldn't support him. He fell to his knees and stayed there. McKinney stood in front of him, looking dark and huge in that cowhide vest. The rancher grinned and rubbed his swollen knuckles with his other hand.
You may have won the card game, you son of a bitch, but you lost everything else. And you're just getting started learning how much you've lost.
When Conrad woke up, he was lying in a soft, comfortable bed between crisp, clean sheets. The shock of those surroundings was so great, it was almost like someone had thrown a bucket of cold water in his face.
Brandon's awake. Go tell the boss.
A door opened and closed, and it was followed by a sound Conrad knew all too well. The sound of gun hammers being drawn back. He opened his eyes, wincing a little as light struck them. Sunlight slanted in through a window with the curtains drawn back. As his vision cleared, he saw two men standing at the foot of the bed. Each man had a double-barreled shotgun pointed at him, and the weapons were cocked and ready to fire.
Better be careful with those scatter guns, boys. Oh, if they go off, at this range, there won't be much of me left. Your boss won't like that.
Mr. McKinney said we was to go ahead and kill you if you try anything else. I reckon he's damn sick and tired of your tricks, mister.
Conrad felt too weak for any tricks. He closed his eyes again and lay there, trying to regain some of his strength as he took a quick inventory of his aches, pains, and bruises. Yep, he decided after a moment. He hurt pretty much from head to toe. The rancher looked pleased with himself as he grinned down at his battered prisoner.
Well, I'm glad to see you're not dead. You'd be getting off too easy if you were.
What the hell are you talking about, McKinney? I never did anything to you except beat you at a game of cards.
McKinney waved his left hand. His right rested on the walnut butt of the Colt holstered on his hip.
I don't care about the money. It's what you did to that poor woman you got to pay for, Browning.
Poor woman? You mean the woman calling herself Rose Sullivan?
Not her. That gal can take care of herself better than any I ever saw. I'm talking about Pamela Tarleton.
I don't know what she told you, but chances are it was a lie.
That woman never told a lie in her life.
The conviction in the rancher's voice told Conrad that Pamela had worked her magic on him, had woven a spell like some latter-day Circe, and convinced McKinney to believe whatever lies she laid out for him. She had probably taken McKinney to bed. She had been able to make any man believe anything when the falsehoods were accompanied by soft, sleek flesh and softer kisses.
She explained everything to me. She told me how you went loco and threatened her, how she had to break off your engagement and run away from you just to save herself. She told me about how you've been trying to kill her ever since then, how she had to hide out. She didn't dare tell you about those kids, because she knew that would make you even worse. She said if you ever found out, you'd try to track her down. She made me promise that if the trail led you to me, I'd stop you. So that's just what I'm gonna do.
You've got it all wrong. I just want to find my children.
So you can mistreat them like you mistreated their mother? Not a chance in hell, Browning. I know what I've got to do. You're never going to leave this ranch alive. But we're going to have some fun making sure you wind up dead.
The vengeful expression on McKinney's face and the cruel anticipation in his voice made it clear what Conrad was dealing with. It was true Pamela had duped McKinney as she had duped so many others. But the rancher had had a mile-wide streak of viciousness and evil in him before he ever met her. Conrad had seen that for himself the first night he had run into McKinney, during that altercation in the palace. He might have built a successful ranch for himself, but he was still a cold-blooded killer at heart, and the hard cases who worked for him weren't much better. Conrad wasn't sure exactly where Rose Sullivan fit into things, but he knew she was working with McKinney. That increased the odds against him.
You can't get away with kidnapping me. When I disappear, too many people will ask questions. They know you had it in for me. They'll come looking for me, and this ranch is the first place they'll look.
Let them look. Nobody on the Double Star will talk. My men are all loyal to me. By the time anybody actually searches the place, the buzzards will have picked your bones clean, and the coyotes will have scattered them all over hell and gone. Get up and get dressed.
For the first time, Conrad realized he was naked.
When he's got his clothes on, bring him downstairs.
And if he tries anything, boss?
Blow him to hell.
McKinney grinned at Conrad again.
You see, Browning, I'd rather carry out what I got planned for you. But as long as you wind up dead, I reckon I can accept it. Don't let him get too close to you. He's fast and tricky.
The cowboys nodded in understanding and backed off, keeping the shotguns leveled at Conrad.
You heard the boss. Get out of bed and get them clothes on.
The man motioned slightly with the twin barrels of his greener. Conrad looked in the direction the man indicated and saw a pair of denim trousers and a plain work shirt draped over a chair. He pushed the sheets back and swung his legs out of bed.
I don't see any boots.
If the boss wanted you to wear boots, there'd be some boots there. Now hurry up, damn it!
Conrad sensed their nervousness. They were afraid he would try something. At the same time, they hoped he would. Then they could pull the triggers on those scatter guns and have it all over and done with. He didn't want to give them any excuse to do that, so he moved slowly and carefully as he stood up, went to the chair, and started pulling on the clothes McKinney had provided. When he was dressed, one of the guards opened the door and backed out through it, keeping his shotgun level. The other two guards flanked Conrad.
You realize that if you shoot me now, you'll kill each other too?
The guard's eyes widened.
Damn! He's right!
Don't worry. I'm cooperating. For now.
He had looked around enough to see that the room was simple but comfortably furnished. And as he stepped out into the hall and felt a thick rug under his bare feet, he saw the same seemed to be true of the rest of the house. A few yards away, the hall opened onto a balcony that overlooked a large room on the first floor. Conrad hadn't known until then that he was on the second floor. He figured he was in McKinney's ranch house. The outer walls were made of logs, and there was dark, heavy wood almost everywhere he looked. The horns of deer, moose, antelope, and elk adorned the walls. It was the sort of house that would be built by a man who had carved an empire out of the frontier. Some men did that sort of thing honestly and honorably. Conrad had a strong hunch Rance McKinney was not that kind of man. It wouldn't surprise him a bit if most of McKinney's first herd had been acquired by the light of a rustler's moon. One of the guards backed away in front of Conrad while the others followed him.
They're waiting for you downstairs.
He went down a broad staircase with thick banisters made from heavy beams. At the bottom, he looked across the big room and saw a table sitting in front of a massive stone fireplace that was cold at that time of the year. The table was set for breakfast, and the aromas of hot coffee and food made Conrad's stomach clench as a reminder of how long it had been since he'd had an actual meal. McKinney sat at one end of the table, Rose at the other. Her pale, wavy hair was loose around her shoulders, which were left partially bare by the low-cut blue gown she wore. McKinney grinned as he got to his feet.
Glad to see you've decided to join us, Browning.
He waved at an empty chair halfway between him and Rose.
Have a seat.
You're putting me in the middle so that if your men cut loose with those greeners, none of the buckshot will hit you or Rose, I take it.
Conrad walked to the chair. He kept his face coolly and passive and didn't let them see how much he hurt all over.
That's right. Sit down.
Conrad sat. The coffee had already been poured into his cup, and the plate in front of him was piled high with steak, eggs, and biscuits. He turned to look at the woman and nodded politely.
Good morning, Rose. Or would you rather I called you by some other name?
Rose will do fine. You really shouldn't have put up such a fuss, Conrad. It would have been much easier on you if you'd cooperated.
Yes, I was always too stubborn for my own good.
That's the truth. Otherwise, you would have given up Pamela when you had the chance and not turned loco.
Conrad started to tell the rancher again that he was making a big mistake, but he gave it up as a waste of breath. After everything that had happened, McKinney would want him dead even without the lies Pamela had told him. McKinney's arrogance would have demanded revenge for that humiliating defeat at the poker table.
Dig in. You might as well enjoy your last meal.
Conrad picked up the coffee and took a sip of the strong black brew. As he did, it occurred to him that McKinney might have had the coffee and food drugged. But why would he do that? He already had Conrad completely in his power. Conrad drank some more of the coffee, making him feel better right away. The food helped even more. He was hungry enough that he wanted to wolf it down, but he forced himself to eat slowly and deliberately.
Just what is it you have planned for me anyway? I know you're going to kill me, but how?
Nobody ever claimed that Rance McKinney wasn't a sporting man.
What does that mean?
He's gonna do something foolish. He's going to give you a chance to fight for your life.
Conrad had hoped McKinney might be leading up to something like that. He would stack the odds against him, sure. But the idea of leaving Conrad one single shred of hope before crushing him would appeal to the rancher. Conrad turned his head to look at Rose.
I suppose you'd just rather put a bullet in my head.
That's right. I was paid to see to it that you wound up dead. But since you and that Italian friend of yours ruined all my other plans, I wound up having to go to Mr. McKinney for help. He's calling the shots now.
Damn right I am. And what we're gonna do is have ourselves a little hunt.
What do you mean by that?
The Double Star is a big place. My range runs for miles back up into the foothills. My men are going to take you out there and leave you, just like you are now. No gun, no boots, just the clothes on your back. And then we're going to track you down and kill you like an animal.
That doesn't sound like a very sporting chance to me.
Better than you'd get with that devil.
McKinney nodded toward Rose at the other end of the table. She didn't appear to take offense at the characterization.
You're probably right about that.
Conrad ate some more of the food and washed it down with the coffee, making an effort to stay calm. He had said people would come looking for him, but he didn't know if that was true. He wasn't sure who it would be. Arturo was still in the hospital, and he wasn't any sort of frontiersman. Bat Masterson would deliver the bank draft for Conrad's winnings to Ellery Hudson to be deposited in one of Conrad's accounts, but neither of them would have any reason to suspect something had happened to him in time to help him. Nobody else in Denver cared one way or the other about him. He was probably on his own, he told himself. Alone, on foot, weaponless, with a horde of killers coming after him. That was the fate McKinney had in mind for him. McKinney didn't know it yet, Conrad thought, without an ounce of bravado. But the rancher had made a bad mistake by not killing him right away. At that moment, the man sitting at the table, calmly eating his breakfast before being taken out to be hunted down like an animal, might still look like Conrad Browning. But Kid Morgan was back. The kid enjoyed the meal and ate plenty. One thing a man on the drift learned in a hurry was to eat when he got the chance. You never knew when the opportunity might come around again. McKinney started to get impatient.
There's no use in you stalling, Browning. Things are going to turn out the same no matter what you do.
The kid drained the last of the coffee in his cup and set it down on its saucer of fine china.
Do what you have to do, McKinney.
Damn right I will.
McKinney gestured toward the guards who had stood by during the meal.
Get him on his feet.
The kid stood up without waiting for the men to force him to leave the table. He wanted to get out of there, wanted to have a chance to move around again and plan his strategy to turn the tables on the rancher. The first order of business would be to get his hands on a gun, but that would have to wait. At the headquarters of the Double Star, he was surrounded by dozens of hard cases toting Colts and shotguns. No matter how good he was, he couldn't buck those odds. McKinney scraped his chair back, too.
Tie his hands behind him and take him out to the wagon. Be careful. Don't let him try anything.
The kid smiled faintly. He wasn't going to try anything. Yet. McKinney looked at the woman sitting at the other end of the table.
You coming along?
No, you don't need me. I've done my part. Just make sure he dies.
Count on it.
While a couple of men covered the kid with their shotguns, another of McKinney's punchers came up behind him, jerked his arms behind his back, and lashed his wrists together with several strands of rawhide. The man jerked the knots so tight the kid's fingers began to get numb right away as the circulation was cut off. That might prove to be a problem later, he thought. But he would deal with it when the time came. Once his hands were tied, the guards prodded the kid toward the front door of the ranch house. They went outside into the bright morning sunlight. A wagon was parked in front of the house, probably the same one that had brought him out here, the kid decided. He hoped they wouldn't cover him back up with some damn stinking blanket again.
Get him in the back.
McKinney followed them out onto the porch. Men grabbed the kid's arms and hustled him down the steps and across the yard to the wagon. He didn't put up a fight. The wagon's tailgate was already down. When they reached it, the men took hold of the kid and literally lifted him and pushed him into the wagon bed. His sore muscles protested as he hit down and rolled across the rough planks. Awkwardly, because his hands were tied behind his back, the kid worked his way into a sitting position. A couple of men climbed onto the wagon seat. One of them took hold of the reins, while the other turned around and leveled a revolver at the kid. Other men moved up on horseback, flanking the wagon on both sides. The shotguns had been put away, but half a dozen Colts were pointed at the kid, and he knew that they could shoot him to pieces in a matter of heartbeats.
You know where to take him.
Sure, boss.
The wagon lurched into motion, making the kid sway back and forth since he couldn't use his hands to brace himself. The slashing hooves of the team and the swiftly turning wagon wheels raised a cloud of dust as the vehicle moved away from the ranch. The guards galloped alongside it, except for one man who trailed behind the vehicle, eating the dust. The kid didn't waste any time feeling sorry for the man riding drag, since the varmint probably would be trying to kill him before the day was over. It was a rough ride. The wagon headed northwest, toward the foothills and the snow-capped Rockies beyond that formed a majestic backdrop for the ranch headquarters. The sky was a brilliant blue with a few white clouds floating in it. Denver's crowded streets and the smoky gambling rooms of the palace seemed a million miles away, not just 40 or 50. The kid sat in the back of the wagon with his head down. It probably looked like an attitude of despair to McKinney's men, but it wasn't. He was gathering his strength and clearing his mind, preparing himself to face what seemed like overwhelming odds. The way to deal with odds like that, the kid knew, was to whittle them down bit by bit. In order to do that, he had to make them think he had given up, so they wouldn't be expecting him to fight back later on. A couple of hours passed as the wagons penetrated deeper into the foothills. The sun climbed higher in the sky and made the temperature rise. The kid didn't bother wishing he had a hat, knowing that would be a waste of time. Finally, the driver hauled back on the reins and brought the wagon to a halt in front of a long line of rugged gray and brown cliffs about a half a mile away. He turned and told the men on horseback,
"All right, get him out of there."
A couple of guards dismounted and approached the wagon while the others continued to cover the kid. They reached into the back of the vehicle, grabbed the kid's legs, and roughly hauled him out. He fell off the tailgate and landed hard. While he lay there, half stunned, one of the men drew a knife and bent over to slash the rawhide bonds around the kid's wrist.
He's loose!
The man stepped back quickly.
You got 1 hour, Browning. Then the boss and the rest of us are coming after you.
The driver moved the wagon away and turned it around, leaving the kid lying in the dirt. He tried to push himself up into a sitting position, but his hands were like lumps of dead meat and went out from under him. He slumped back down onto an elbow.
Let's go!
All the men who had dismounted swung back up into their saddles. The driver of the wagon whipped the team into motion. Dust billowed and swirled in the air again as McKinney's men headed back the way they had come. They wouldn't return all the way to ranch headquarters, though, the kid mused as he watched them gallop away. The spokesman had said that they would come after him in an hour's time. They would rendezvous with McKinney somewhere between there and the Double Star Ranch House, and the hunt would begin in earnest. The kid flexed his fingers and welcomed the fierce, stabbing pain that shot through his hands. The blood was flowing again. He turned his head to gaze at the rugged cliffs. They stretched as far to the north and south as he could see. He couldn't get around them, not in the time McKinney was giving him. The rancher had stacked the odds in his favor by choosing that place for his men to dump the kid, planning to drive his quarry toward the cliffs and trap him there. Like an animal, he'd said more than once, and he meant it. Cornered animals were often the most dangerous, though, the kid thought, as a grim smile touched his mouth. He flexed his fingers again. His hands were starting to work, and he pushed himself up. He made it to his knees, then climbed to his feet. The rocky ground was rough on his feet as he started toward the cliffs. He ignored the discomfort and lifted his gaze to the heights beyond those cliffs. The terrain rose in a series of bluffs and canyons that climbed steadily into the mountains. He needed that high ground, and as far as he could see, there was only one way to get there. McKinney probably thought it was impossible for any man to climb those cliffs. Kid Morgan intended to prove him wrong. His feet began to bleed before he reached the cliffs, but he didn't slow down. He didn't have much time. He had to get there, find a way up, and make it to the top before McKinney and the rest of the killers returned. If they caught him out in the open, trying to pull himself up a few inches at a time, it would be like target practice for them. They could sit down there and take pot shots at him all day, until one of them decided to put him out of his misery. The cliffs seemed to loom higher and higher as he approached them. In reality, they were probably about 100 feet tall, he judged. Although from a distance they had looked smooth and sheer, as he came closer, he saw that they weren't. They had a slight slope to them in places, and there were rocky outcrops and fissures here and there. If he'd had plenty of time and maybe a rope to help him, climbing the cliffs would be a challenge, but certainly not impossible. He didn't have either of those things, he reminded himself. But even though he couldn't change time, he might be able to do something about the other. As he trotted toward the cliffs, he stripped his shirt off. The sun was going to blister his skin, but that was a minor worry. The shirt was made of sturdy fabric that resisted tearing, but he was able to get a place started with his teeth and began ripping strips from it. When he had enough of them, he began weaving them together and knotting them into a makeshift rope. A short time later, he reached the base of the cliffs. He estimated that a quarter of an hour had gone by since McKinney's men had galloped off, leaving him with about 45 minutes before they returned. He tipped his head back and searched the face of the cliff above him. No handholds were within arm's reach, but he spotted a rocky knob he might be able to catch with the rope he had made from his shirt. From there, he could reach other places where he could get a grip and hoist himself higher. If he could angle over a short distance, he might be able to get into a narrow crack he saw zigzagging toward the top. It petered out, but there was another outcropping above it that might give him a handhold. Quickly, his eyes traced a possible path to the top. Following it would require clinging to the rock with fingers and toes like some sort of human insect and stretching himself almost beyond his ability to reach. There might be an easier route somewhere else, he thought as he formed a loop in the makeshift rope, but he didn't have time to search for it. It was this way or nothing, and the kid wasn't anywhere close to being ready to give up. He had never worked as a ranch hand, but his father had taught him a little about handling a lasso. He gave it a few easy twirls, then cast the loop at the knob that was his target. The loop fell short. The kid bit back his impatience and tried again. It took 5 casts before the loop caught well enough to support his weight. The kid leaned hard on the rope to make sure it was going to hold, then began walking up the cliff as he pulled himself along, hand over hand. A moment later, he was able to hang on with one hand and reach higher with the other. His fingers clamped over a rough spot that stuck out far enough for him to get a good grip. He pulled himself up, loosened the rope and slung it around his neck so he could take it with him, and used the knob as a foothold. The minutes flowed past with maddening speed. The kid couldn't pull himself up more than a few inches at a time. If he lifted himself an entire foot in one try, it was a huge victory. But when he reached the crack he had spotted from below, he realized it was a little bigger than he thought. He was able to worm his whole body into it and lift himself by pressing with his feet and back. He left bloody streaks on both sides of the crack as the rocky surface tore and scraped his skin. But what was a little blood when his life was at stake, he asked himself. And it wasn't just his life at stake. If he was ever going to find his children, if he was ever going to make a life for them with him, he had to survive. He had escaped from Hellgate Prison, he thought, and he had made it through quite a few other ordeals. He could do this. For his sake. For the sake of little Frank and Vivian. His body was slick with sweat and blood, and he began slipping. The rocks dug into his flesh as he caught himself. He had lost track of time, and didn't know how long it would be before McKinney and the other men who wanted to kill him showed up. Turning his head, he looked out across the flats and saw dust boiling up. They were on their way, and he was only about halfway to the top of the cliff. The kid started climbing again. He reached the top of the crack and moved on to the face of the cliff again, clinging desperately to it. He was high enough that a fall would probably be fatal. Exhaustion made his muscles tremble. He forced them to work and pulled himself higher. When he reached an outcropping that was big enough for him to lie down, he stretched out for a few moments, knowing he couldn't afford the time, but also aware that his body could be driven only so far without a little rest. After he had taken about a dozen deep breaths, he struggled back to his feet and looked up, studying the path that rose above him. He had to use the rope again to lasso another jutting rock. Above that, he picked out several handholds and footholds that would get him almost to the top. He had a chance, he told himself, a real chance. He didn't look to see how close McKinney and the others were. There was no point in it. He would make it or he wouldn't. Simple as that. After a couple of casts, the crude lasso caught the rock. The kid pulled himself up. His toes went in a crack in the rock and his other hand found a grip. He didn't need the lasso anymore. He could make it from there without it. 10 feet. 5. He could see the top of the cliff, tantalizingly close. He shifted a foot, dug his bloody toes into a narrow opening, and lifted himself. Reaching again, he closed his hand over an outcropping. He was almost close enough to stretch out and grasp the rim rock itself. It exploded right above his head in a shower of rock splinters and dust as rifles began to crack somewhere below him. The kid fought off the urge to make a desperate leap and try to grab the edge of the cliff. The odds of him being able to do that were so slim, he stood a better chance if he continued the climb with the rifle bullets whipping and zinging around him. He clamped down on his nerves and reached for the next handhold. Firing upward at such a sharp angle was tricky. Most of the slugs struck the cliff below him or sailed over his head. A few pocked the rock face around him, causing little chips of rock to sting his bare torso. He expected to feel the smashing impact of a bullet at any second, but until that happened, he was going to keep pulling himself toward the top. He got a good hold and pulled himself forward. The rim rock was within reach. Rance McKinney was a good 100 feet below him.
Shoot him! Shoot the salt man! $500, whoever brings him down! $1,000!
The kid stretched his right hand up and closed it over the rocky brink. He shifted his left leg and pushed upward with it. His left hand clamped onto the rim rock as well. He got the toes of his right foot in a tiny crack and put his weight on them, at the same time, hauling himself upward with all the strength he had left in his arms and shoulders. His shoulders cleared the top of the cliff, then the rest of his torso, and then he was toppling forward, rolling away from the edge as bullets continued to scream through the air. But they couldn't reach him. The cliff cut him off from view of McKinney and his men.
Hold the fire! Get the horse! Get the horses, damn you! We'll get up there and cut him off. He can't get away from us.
McKinney didn't understand. The kid didn't want to get away. He wanted to meet his enemies on his own terms, at a time and place of his own choosing. He rolled onto his side, then got to his feet. Pain shot through him as he put his weight on those lacerated soles. He hobbled toward a sandstone bluff that rose to the mouth of the canyon. McKinney's reaction told the kid that what he'd suspected all along was right. There was a trail leading to the top of the cliffs. It had been too far away for him to have reached it on foot in the time they had given him, but on horseback, his pursuers could get there a lot faster. He didn't know how much time he had before they would be up there trying to pick up his trail. Unfortunately, the bloody footprints he was leaving behind with every step meant he would be easy to follow. Although he hated to take the time to do it, he paused long enough to tear strips of denim cloth from the trousers he wore using a sharp rock. He wrapped those strips around his feet and tied them in place. They served the dual purpose of protecting his feet and slowing down the bleeding, so he wouldn't leave such an obvious trail. Once he had done that, he was able to move a little faster. While he hurried toward the bluff, he thought about what he was going to do. He needed a gun, a horse, and some boots, not necessarily in that order. He would take them however he could get them, but it wouldn't be easy. His best chance would be to jump McKinney or one of the rancher's men while they were alone. The kid wasn't sure how many men McKinney had with him, but it stood to reason they would have to spread out some as they searched for him. If he could overpower one of them without any shots being fired or an alarm raised, that would be his best chance. Gunfire would bring the rest of them at a gallop, and he would be right back where he started, outnumbered and alone. He reached the foot of the bluff. It was pretty steep, but some scrubby bushes grew out of it, and by holding on to the branches, he was able to pull himself up the slope. When he reached the top, he found himself looking down a narrow canyon no more than 100 yards wide. In places, it closed in even more than that. Some sparse, hardy grass grew on the canyon floor, and pine trees dotted the rim rock on both sides. The faint rataplan of distant hoofbeats drifted to the kid's ears. He couldn't tell if the riders were still below the cliffs or if they had found the trail and reached the top. Either way, he intended to be gone by the time they got there. Taking a deep breath, he plunged into the canyon and broke into a trot that sent jolts of agony from his feet up through his body with every step he took.